Welcome back to Unlapped. Five races down and first sprint weekend of the F1 season is in the books. The gang is finally back together after a couple of weeks. Nate Saunders, Lawrence Edmondson joining me. Lawrence, I'll start with you because I have an understanding that you just landed in England after your travels in China. Is that correct? How are you feeling? How are you even awake right now?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think my body sooner or later is just going to shut down. So if it happens during the podcast, I apologize in advance. It was an interesting trip. It's obviously, as so many people mentioned, 5 years since we've been in China for Formula One. And it was really quite interesting going back, seeing the track, which some of it had changed a little bit. But, you know, for the most part, it was a reminder of what a good circuit that is, a purpose-built circuit. We talk so much about street circuits in F1, and we seem to keep getting them. But this was a purpose-built kind of blank sheet of paper circuit, and it really shows. And then also the level of enthusiasm from the fans was on a level which is hard to match. I mean, you know, we had Japan 2 weeks before, and there's some very enthusiastic fans there. But I would say China is now rivaling Japan in terms of inventiveness of fans, passion of fans, and just sheer creativity of fans. I think one of my favorite things I saw was a yellow luminous vest that said Stake Sauber pit stop supervisor on the back. And there were about, I don't know, I'd say about 20 people walking around in this big gang. And to me, that was great. Like, not only were they supporting their home driver, Zhou Guanyu, with Sauber Stake, but they were also picking up on something which has been a real issue for that team this year, which is the slow pit stop. So, yeah, pretty cool. And we had a little bit of everything over the weekend, including some spontaneous combustion in the infield when the grass set fire in practice and qualifying, which I've never seen before a race weekend. So, yeah, it kept me on my toes. So still kind of riding that adrenaline rush back to the UK, but I'm sure I'm going to fall asleep anytime soon.
Quickly, what was it like seeing Zhou Guanyu obviously race in his first home race of his Formula One career?
It was great. And it has been a long time coming. Obviously, he joined Formula One a couple of years back and hasn't had that opportunity. And clearly emotional at the end. I think, you know, for the most part of the weekend, he did a good job to keep everything kind of sensible and did a good job, especially in the sprint qualifying and the sprint race. Unfortunately, his race didn't go to plan, but then at the end you saw that emotion come out, and you know, I think it was huge. And a lot of people picked up on that social post he put out ahead of the race weekend, which was a picture of young Zhou Guanyu with a kind of smile on his face, Ferrari hat, watching what looked like turn one, and how if you chase your dreams, you know, they can come true. So it was a cool story to follow, and I'm really happy that he got his opportunity to race in front of his home fans. Whether we'll see him again in China, I don't know, because, you know, his situation for next year is not looking great, but at least he had that one opportunity. And I think also China, the fans at least came out to support him in a way that any teams considering him for next year might think, actually, you know, he could still be a key to that market, which we know potentially is hugely lucrative to brands. So we'll see.
I thought it was by far one of the best moments of the weekend, without a doubt. And obviously we've come to expect dominance from Max Verstappen, and that's exactly what we got in China. Of the current tracks on the calendar, this was a race that Max had never won prior. Singapore still is on that list, but this was his 58th Formula One race win, his 31st win from pole. Now he ties Sebastian Vettel for third most of all time. I feel like for the last two seasons, Nate, we have asked this question in a variety of different ways. Are we witnessing something truly special this season from Max Verstappen? I don't know how else to phrase it at this point. Just what did you make of his entire weekend from start to finish?
Yeah, he's just doing something unbelievable every weekend, it seems like. You know, he's so far ahead of everybody else. And I actually saw a stat. I think I'm going to get the actual stat itself slightly wrong, but I think there's been 110 races since the last race in China, between 2019 Chinese Grand Prix and this one. Max has won 55 of those races, and everyone else has won 55. So it shows you just in that time, you know, how one-sided it's been. And obviously, for two of those seasons, Lewis was the dominant guy. So, you know, pretty impressive stat. But also shows you kind of, you know, relatively how little Max had won before, you know, this period started. He's just unbelievable. I mean, obviously, the rain kind of shook things up a bit in the sprint, but other than qualifying fourth in that race, as soon as he was past, you know, past the cars he needed to be past, he was just untouchable. And it never, even with, you know, that situation in the sprint, even with the safety cars in the race, you never really truly felt that Max was really under threat. There's not a huge amount of jeopardy out in front, and there's a lot of reasons for that, but one of the big reasons is because Max and that car are just on a different level. And, you know, reliability now is so good. Obviously, they've had one issue already, but it was kind of a freak accident, incident in Australia. When everything's going right, Max is just on a different plane altogether. And the scary thing is that I just don't... You see him win by, 14 seconds, and he had a huge lead before the safety car, so it could have been an even bigger victory margin. We don't know how much Max is keeping in reserve. I'm sure he's pushing and pushing all the time. But as well, when you're out in front, you don't push to the absolute limit for obvious reasons. You know, there's no need to force a mistake. So as much as it's tantalizing sometimes to look at the gaps to other teams, I think Max is performing at a super high level, and there may well be a little bit left. You know, we know how good Max is wheel-to-wheel racing. You know, we've seen it before. He's right on that line, as we saw in 2021. We haven't really had the chance to see Max do that, which is a shame, because I think it's actually one of Max's most entertaining traits, is just the fact that he's so good and so willing to race wheel-to-wheel. And it's been so long that we've nearly forgotten that is part of his trait. At the moment, I think Christian Horner compared it to a metronome. Just the pace is just, it's just like he's ticking over every lap and it's the same. Mm-hmm. And it's a really good way of describing it, because it's robotic almost. And it's hard to see anybody disrupting that groove anytime soon.
He's now won 4 out of the 5 Grand Prix of the season by more than 10 seconds. As you mentioned, 14 here, dominated the sprint race. We talked about it, Nate, last week, about the format. Laz, on the ground, what did you think of the sprint format, having gotten to see the first sprint race of the season now?
I think it's the best we've had so far in terms of the way this sprint format works out, because, you know, it's a more logical flow to the weekend. I think having Grand Prix qualifying on the Friday always seems slightly odd, because that would happen and you'd be like, all right, well, now we have to wait till Sunday to figure out how that grid's going to shake out. And then it also introduces this ability for teams to change setup between the sprint race and Grand Prix qualifying. And I think that is an interesting factor to have, because I think increasingly you'll see teams really go for, you know, substantial setup changes there, because one, they're learning the whole way through. Of course, they only have the one practice session in the sprint format, so they'll be learning in sprint quali and then in the sprint race itself. But also, it's a different fuel load. So they start the sprint race on a very relatively low fuel load to do a third distance. They start the race on a full fuel load to do the full distance. And you're asking different things of the tires. So I think teams will start to get even more clever with that. But we can also see that throw in the occasional mistake. I mean, if you look at Lewis Hamilton, it was a shame, because that's one of the drivers who we actually want to see maybe perform better as a result of these mid-weekend setup changes, because, you know, he's had a pretty slow start to the year, but he was very good in the sprint. They made some changes thinking that, you know, they can maximize the car even more, and it went the other way. So there's still there's that element of jeopardy there. And also it should eliminate any possibility of the situation we had in Austin, where they couldn't change the ride height level and they got disqualified because of plank wear. You know, that's a bit, you know, rubbish to see when there's all this effort going into setting up these cars that they can't just change stuff to avoid being falling foul of the regulations. So I would say good. I don't know how it looked for you guys, but I would say good.
I thought it made the most sense in consequential order, if that made, like, to your point, when you would have qualifying for the race on that Friday, that didn't go in order in the way my mind works from an organizational standpoint. So I definitely preferred this. Nate, I don't know if you would agree.
Yeah, definitely. Made way more sense. What I would say for me, it was 4 a.m. in the UK, the sprint, so I didn't watch that. I just watched it on repeat after. I thought my phone was bugging when I looked at the F1 app, because it said Max had won by 13 seconds in a 17-second race. But I have to say, I think that was a good example of when the sprint can really be a good thing. I think the rain helped. You know, you're not always going to get rain in a qualifying session and mixing things up. So I think that you have to kind of caveat that a little bit, because if it hadn't rained, I imagine Max, you know, who knows? I mean, it might have been different, but you can't always say, oh, like a wet qualifying session, because the sprint itself, I think the issue you have with the sprint is the final couple of laps just seem to peter out, because there's no, you know, everyone's by then on the same strategy. The guys who are on the softs, you know, they've either gained the position or they haven't. But as we've always said, it's, you know, it's a very, very long season. So it's great to have a bit of difference, you know, through the year.
I've got an interesting question for you guys, because when you think of greats, no matter the sport, right? NFL, you think of Tom Brady. Patrick Mahomes obviously has had a tremendous amount of success, as you point to your Buccaneers.
Sorry, I completely distracted you in the middle of
You did. I was like, what is he putting? Oh, that's a Buccaneer sweatshirt.
I thought you could see it better, but
yeah, no, terrible. Now I got it.
Very unprofessional for me. I apologize.
No, I love it. I love it. Although nobody really associates him with the Bucs, by the way. Like, Patriots is where he won his.
Yeah, true.
Anyways, sidetrack. So when you think of like Tom Brady, Pat Mahomes, you think of a Michael Jordan, LeBron James, Tiger Woods, if you want to go golf. Like, there were so many talented players around their same age, same generation, that maybe never found the same success because they were unfortunately came out or were drafted in the same few years as a Tom Brady or Patrick Mahomes. I feel like Max Verstappen is the F1 equivalent of those greats at this point, that he's been so dominant that it stopped maybe some great young talent like a Lando Norris or a Charles Leclerc from putting up race wins and good results. Do you think that that's fair? It's just an unfortunate part of your age or when you came out or when you joined Formula One, if you were in and around Max Verstappen's, you know, same time period, Lewis Hamilton, Michael Schumacher, could you make that case?
Yeah, I think so, massively. I mean, it's kind of, you. Obviously, we don't know what the next few years will look like, but you feel like there could be this almost kind of like lost generation of opportunity for a lot of those guys. I mean, off the top of my head, you know, if you combine George Russell, Charles Leclerc, and Lando's wins, I think you'd have six, which is mad. You know, if you compare that to, and they're not, you know, I don't know what the maths is off the top of my head, but they're not that much worse than Max is, you know, relatively speaking. But yeah, it does just happen. And I mean, the Lando case is the one that really is baffling, because, you know, he hasn't got that win. And if you think about Russell won in 2022, we never really talk about, oh, will Russell get a win? He's got it. He's ticked it off. Lando hasn't done that. And with Max being this good, you just don't know when he will even get that first win. You know, he hasn't even got the sprint victory that Piastri has. So I think it is a drawback of it. And obviously, the longer it goes on, it creates a different kind of narrative. I'm trying to think of any obvious examples of people that, you know, couldn't win because of a great set of players around them. But I'll use one that's a bit closer to home for me and Lawrence, which is Andy Murray in tennis. I mean, he won a few majors in his time, but, you know, for anybody who doesn't follow tennis, he was also playing at the time when you had Roger Federer, Nadal, Rafael, and Djokovic, you know, and he lost to Federer in a bunch of finals. He lost to Nadal in a bunch of finals. And he lost to Djokovic, I think, in like 5 Australian Opens. So without those guys, he could have been one of the best players of all time. He still had a great legacy, but you wonder without those guys. And yeah, it is interesting, because you've had Lewis and you've had Max, and you look at even guys like Sergio Perez, you know, he's had a handful of wins. He hasn't really done too much more. Danny Ricciardo, you know, had a few wins and then just hasn't really done anything for a few years. There's guys that kind of just get lost in the shuffle. And as soon as you've moved out of a championship winning position, hard to get back to it as well. So I think that that's actually really interesting to keep an eye on, is especially Lando, because I think Lando's become such a pinup for younger fans, and I think he's probably one of the most popular drivers around. And he doesn't, you know, he's got one, you know, Pierre Gasly and Esteban Ocon both have one more win than him, you know, and it's a really strange situation. I'm sure it won't last, but you can't guarantee it. I mean, Fernando Alonso's not won in 10 years, so there's no, just because Lando's good enough doesn't mean he will win a race. You assume he should, but
15 podiums now for Lando without a win.
And it's interesting, isn't it? Because usually in a, you know, there's no guarantee you win a Super Bowl in a, you know, in the NFL or whatever, but you assume if you're good enough, you'll have a chance to do it. And Lando's had one or two chances maybe, but who knows? And yeah, Max just at the front. Lando must just go home and just think, what have I got to do to get one of these? You know, Max is there winning. What is he on, 50, 55, 56?
I believe 58.
58. So yeah, I'm losing count myself. So, but yeah, no, I think it's a really good point, Casey, because it I think it's becoming quite stark when you compare it to, you know, how the other guys in the grid are doing.
Yeah, and I think it's even more extreme than the tennis example. I completely agree with that. But here, there's a lot taken out of these guys' hands in that, you know, the car that they're in, they have some influence on how competitive it is, but not a huge amount. And so you can find yourself out of a competitive car. But that doesn't mean that F1 drivers who don't have masses of success on track and a huge amount of wins aren't considered legends in the sport. I think back to Gilles Villeneuve, you know, he only had a handful of wins at the end of his career, yet is considered one of the most talented exciting racing drivers ever to have lived. Stirling Moss never won a world championship, yet is, you know, one of the legendary names from the 1950s, you know, potentially the second most kind of revered after Juan Manuel Fangio. So I think the nature of the sport means that, you know, drivers can go periods without winning. And then to use Max as an example himself, the first six seasons of his career, you know, he was on incredible form, hugely talented. I think won about 10 races, you know, and then the rest have come since the dominant car has come in. So it's true, but also when we talk about Norris, Leclerc, stuff like that, you know, they're in their mid-20s. So I dread to think that Formula One will continue with Max Verstappen dominance through to, you know, 2032, 2033, because then I don't think there's going to be much of a sport left, because people will just naturally tune out if you know who's going to be winning going into it. And I don't think that will happen, because the nature of F1, and if we look back at the periods when other drivers have dominated, be it Hamilton, be it Vettel, be it Schumacher, you know, prior to that, you had a period of McLaren dominance. Williams were incredibly competitive in 92, 93, you know, completely unmatchable. Well, regulations change, and then teams, you know, change as well. Engineers leave, go to different places. You know, we're seeing that already with Ferrari. There's a lot of hope that the Lewis factor is going to change things there going into 26. So I agree, this is a thing. And I agree that, you know, the amount of wins that Lando has, that Leclerc has, that George has, don't reflect how great a driver they are, but they're not done yet. And I think, you know, these kind of periods do happen in F1. And even those drivers that never quite make, you know, consistent victories and championships can still be absolute legends within the sport. Sometimes even more so, because they were always struggling in a car that, you know, and you never quite got to see the potential fulfilled. That often leaves something a little bit extra too.
Yeah, Montoya's another one like that. Obviously, he won a few races, but was one of Schumacher's big rivals, and you never quite saw him in a championship position. One thing on that I think, just to throw forward from what Lawrence said, that I think is interesting, and obviously, unless you're in that person's head, you won't know. It's been really fascinating to see that Charles has been struggling, especially, you know, his kind of old strength of qualifying hasn't been as strong. And, you know, he's not as comfortable in the car and stuff like that. But I do wonder what the mental toll on that is on a driver when you know you're good enough to win a race and you know you're good enough to challenge for a championship and you're waiting and waiting and waiting. And on top of all that, you're making career decisions down the line. And a lot of it is a roll of the dice. You know, you don't know if McLaren is the right call or Ferrari is the right call. And obviously, if you're Max, you're in a good position because you know, I know he's playing around with his future a little bit and saying, I could leave, whatever. He knows he's tied down with the best team for the foreseeable future. If you're Lando, you're Charles, you're George, you just don't know. You're like, I could have signed up for a team that is in the complete, you know, death spiral. You don't know. And Charles's form, I'm not saying all of it's down to, you know, his mental approach and stuff like that, but how quick must, you know, that negativity and that frustration start to turn into you're overdriving, or you start doubting your own abilities and stuff like that. So I think it does start to have a effect on these drivers. And I hope it doesn't, you know, we don't see it. You know, I think Charles, you know, had a much better weekend overall with, you know, in terms of the head-to-head to Carlos Sainz. But you wonder, a guy like that, he hasn't won for coming up to 2 years now. That must be so frustrating for him. And I wonder just how he deals with that, and, you know, what the residual effect of that is coming, especially if Lewis comes in next year. Imagine if Lewis comes in next year and wins the race before Charles does. And that's already in your head. You're like, oh, I'm never going to win a championship. You've got Carlos beating him this year. I don't know. It's just interesting. It's an interesting side angle to the Verstappen dominance that I think we might see cascading down with some of the drivers.
Especially when you know deep down you're talented enough to be a race winner on a consistent basis, which I think we would all agree that Charles Leclerc certainly is, as well as Lando Norris, based on the drives that he's put together, just hasn't quite fallen into place for him. Passion, drive, and patience. What brings home the winning trophy is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. From superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has got you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to turn your car into the MVP and bring home that win. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Now, let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom! Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured. It was green and good! The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
Laz, you mentioned competitive advantage, and I'm just curious real quick, Nate, you have an article up on ESPN.com that F1 plans to discuss a revised point structure kind of to, in hopes maybe to shake up the championship. Just what are the possible proposals there, and what have you heard in terms of what they're going to discuss exactly?
Yeah, so this, the proposal that is being discussed on Thursday, the F1 commission, which includes F1 and all the teams, is to extend the points from top 10 to top 12. And basically, it's actually, I mean, the what was actually leaked, you know, F1, I think, were quite annoyed that this did leak out, you know, into the media. They want to keep everything from first to seventh down the same. And then basically 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th will basically just have 1 point between each of them. And it just basically will open up some of those opportunities. The argument from the smaller teams is that right now the top five teams are a step ahead of the bottom five. So if they all get everything right every week, it's very difficult for those teams to get points. I mean, there's still three teams, I think, Sauber, Alpine and Williams, that haven't scored a point yet. You know, Haas have got about five. Obviously, Sonoda's scored about seven for RB. But, you know, and that is a counter argument, is that, you know, sometimes a freak result can propel you up the order. Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? So I think the small teams want it. And the reason they're keeping the top 7 points the same. So for anyone, so this is going to be quick, quick fire maths for me. So it's 25. 18, 15, 10, 8, 6, 4, 2, 1.
You missed 12, I think.
Nice.
Sorry, yeah, I missed 12. I did miss 12.
There.
And that's thrown me completely. Yeah, so now from, so 8th is four points, 2 points, 1 point. So that will now be 5 because there's a gap, 6 to 4. Six points for 7th, 4 points for 8th. That will now become 5 points for 8th. For 4 points for 9th, 3, 2, 1. So you're basically upping it. Like
Zach, put a graphic up if you can, can visually, if they're watching on YouTube, understand and follow what Nate just presented, please. Okay.
See, when I was writing that article, it made so much sense. And when actually say it. But I think, yeah, it's a good one to discuss, actually, because, and I'd be fascinated to see what Lawrence says about this. Points changes, F1's changed points before. The last one was 2010, which is when this current rule change came in. Also changed, I think it was 2002 or 2003 when Schumacher was dominating, went from 6 points, top six score points to top eight score points. And it is interesting because, you know, I think while there's a very good argument to be made for the small teams to score points, it does also suggest that maybe, you know, F1, the fact they're talking about this and having it happy for it to be discussed, it suggests like, well, the racing isn't maybe as thrilling as it needs to be. We need to have more reasons to talk about stuff lower down. I'm not against it at all, but my view would be if you're concerned about the small teams getting points, just give everyone points. Have 20th down the first down to 20th have points and just scale it in a way that's fair. You know, if because at some point, you know, we've gone 6, 8, 10, 12, you'll do another 10 years of this. You'll be the top 14 should score points. That, you know, so I don't know. It's interesting, but The teams are discussing it, and I think they can defer the vote for later in the year and just keep discussing it. And from what I hear, that seems more likely what they'll do at this point.
What do you think, Laz?
I'm not against it. I think it actually makes a certain amount of sense why you've got a situation where you have five very competitive teams. At the moment, we've got Red Bull, Ferrari, McLaren, Mercedes, Aston Martin. It does lock out those points positions at most races, depending on what's happened to Lance Stroll over the race weekend, as Nate has mentioned before on this podcast. And so opening up a little bit more, I think it will give a fairer picture in the Constructors' Championship as to how those teams have done that are regularly finishing outside the top 10. I could also see the logic, as Nate said, to run it all the way down to 20th. But I think, you know, if you're saying, if you're in the bottom eight of a Grand Prix, You know, maybe you don't deserve to have points, and 12 upwards you do. It's all a little bit, you know, kind of pick whatever you want, really. But I don't see a downside to it, because the points at the front don't change. So those previous points changes that Nate mentioned, the ones at Schumacher time and then thereafter, they actually changed the nature of the points between first and second and so on. So the wins weren't as valuable or became more valuable. And I think where we have it set now is the right kind of value for first to second place. So that's not changing. Okay. So I see just giving an extra, essentially, 2 points, and then, you know, there's a few more points on offer for eighth and ninth. You know, I just don't see it as an issue at all. I think they should do it. And I haven't worked out if there'll be any unintended consequences, but if there are, I'm sure they're the sort that everyone can live with, because as Nate alluded to as well, the issue here is not really who you're giving points to. It's just how competitive and exciting the product is to watch. And I think, you know, changing these points won't solve that, but equally it won't do any harm. So yeah, I think go with it, and then let's look longer term at how you can have a situation where a team like Williams can go into a race weekend with the potential to score better points, and also we can go into a race weekend not knowing who's going to be on top of the podium.
Yeah, also as well, for some place, I mean, you could probably argue this is the case anyway, but getting through to Q3 and stuff like that, like if there's more points on offer, a top 10 start is suddenly a little bit more valuable, because you can play around with the strategy and be like, right now, we just got to make sure we're top 10, not, you know, sorry, top 12, not top 10. So there's definite benefits to it. And I think the proposal is smart, because it, like Lawrence said, it hasn't alienated the top teams. So I actually imagine this will be something that comes into force. I haven't really heard any suggestion there's, you know, big opposition to this. It does seem like everyone is kind of on board with it. I think it might just be like the finer points of it. You know, some of the teams might argue little bits here and there, but and just in case anyone's wondering, after my brilliant summary earlier, the fastest point will stay the same. Fastest lap point will stay the same. It'll just be for the top 12. So if you finish 12th now and you take the fastest lap, you will still get a bonus point. So yeah.
Thank you for clarifying. Yeah, and yeah. This is being discussed Thursday of this week, but as you said, it'll likely be kind of kicked down the road and decided upon later on in the season. There's no kind of indication that they'll make the final decision on Thursday.
Well, they could vote, but I mean, what I was told is it's more likely than not that they will kick it down the road, but they could all arrive in the meeting and say, actually, yeah, let's do it. Okay. But it just, from the conversations I had, it seems like they'll just maybe kick it down the line and then decide, you know, at another time, because I think there's still a few discussion points to have. And Lawrence mentioned the word unintended consequences. I think Formula One just wants to make sure they're not missing something obvious that this would open up down the line. And they've got time to discuss. They don't have to decide right now for next year. So,
okay. All right. Well, we'll obviously wait the decision there. And I want to bring back a game that Laz and I played after Saudi Arabia. Driver's Stock Watch, if we're going to name it that. I think that's fair. I'm going to give you guys a name or a team. And after 5 races in the season at this point, you're going to tell me if you're buying more of their stock, you're holding it for now, or if you're selling. Okay. Do you both want to give an answer on each person or team, or do you want me to ping pong back and forth?
Depends on the driver. Let's ping pong back and forth, but I might jump
in. If you both have a very strong opinion, you can both jump in. Okay. We're going to start with Checo Perez, who rounded out the podium in China with his 8 straight top 5 finish. Laz, I'll start with you. Buying, selling, holding?
Well, I feel like if I were to hold stock in Checo Perez, I wouldn't have a huge amount based on the previous years. So I think what I would do is hold it. Is that I'd probably just hold it. Like, it's a small little nest egg there. It's not really going anywhere. There's a lot of sound, certainly from him, that he might be staying at Red Bull next year. So that could be another reason to hold it, because you never know, you know, things start to go his way, or you know, Max has an issue here or there, he'll win a race. So I'm holding the very small amount of stock that I have in Checo.
Do you feel strongly about adding, or would you like to move on, Nate, to Lando Norris?
I'd hold. Yeah, I'd hold.
Okay, Lando Norris. Nate, buying, selling, holding?
Yeah, always good time to buy Lando stock, I think. I mean, Lando always just proves how good he is, you know, and I think at the moment, the thing with the McLaren situation, as good as Piastri was in his rookie season, Lando's actually really keeping that gap, you know, and the points gap. He seems to outperform him, you know, quite consistently. It is just a case of him getting the good car, but you want to have, you know, I don't know how you carry stocks around, but, you know, a wallet full of Lando Norris stock for whenever McLaren get a championship winning car. So yeah, I think it would take a lot to want to, you know, turn that around at this point.
I'm going to ask about the two drivers that were involved in a pretty wild safety car incident. We're going to start with Lance Stroll. But before that, Laz, on the ground, just what did you make of the incident, the blaming between the two, the comments after the fact?
Yeah, I think it was disappointing from Lance on a number of levels. It kind of felt like a mistake that driving Formula One shouldn't be making. It's quite clear that it often concertinas up the pack ahead of a safety car restart. And it really is the responsibility of the driver behind to keep an eye or keep a distance into the car in front to know what's going to happen, have a bit of awareness around what's going on. Equally, and this was pointed out, I think, by George Russell, that the way they sit in these cars now, you have such little visibility because you have those shrouds over the front tires, you have the halo, you have so much going on. You're sat very low in the car. And also the cars now sit much flatter. They used to be slightly angled up, so your visibility is even lower. So I can understand these kind of things do happen, but if they do happen, it's a clear mistake. Own the mistake, you know, and just say, this was me. And then there's Lance blaming cars in front of him for hitting the brakes too hard. It's like, well, yeah, but, you know, there were about four cars stacked up in front of him, and all it needed was one to hit the brakes by a sensible amount, then the next one hits the brakes more. You know, this is why we have pileups on highways and freeways all the time, because this kind of, you know, concertina effect happens, and all it takes is one person at the back looking at their phone, and the next thing you know, they've all gone through each other. And I feel like Lance was a little bit like the one guy at the back looking at his phone. So yeah, I can't get on Lance's side on this, and I think most people in F1 feel the same, but I'm sure there's a few who support Lance.
I think as a fan, I'd have more respect for a guy if he just came out of a race and said, hey, I f***ed up. Like, that's on me. But it's never that. Like, we rarely, sometimes we do, but we rarely get just a straight up, that one's on me, let's move on. There's some kind of excuse attached to it or finger pointing that I'm going to blame somebody else. I thought it was interesting. Lance said, you know, the car in front of me just stopped from like 60 to zero. So it was a really stupid incident. It was one of those. Well, Oscar Piastri was actually asked about it, and he was like, yeah, but everyone else didn't crash into each other. So I'm not buying his explanation. I think in that kind of corner, you always have to kind of expect that, which I thought was an interesting explanation for Oscar Piastri. I love that everybody else gets pulled into it, like they have nothing to do with the incident, but then people want their opinions on it. So with that, Lance Stroll, are you, I assume, selling stock at this point, both of you?
Yeah, and what's that thing called where you bet against it? Is it shorting? I think I'm shorting. Is that?
Big short.
I don't want to start like a subprime like crash on, you know, on Lance Stroll, but yeah, I feel like I'm going to be doing something clever to kind of like make money out of money going out of the stock. I don't know how you do that, but I'm sure there's a way.
Well, it's Anthony Bourdain from The Big Short, isn't it? He takes all of the bad food and puts it in a good pot, mixes it together, and then he makes. I can't remember the film exactly. But yeah, that's good. I was going to make a clever joke about finding a big bonfire, writing all the stocks out and just throwing them on there, because I don't want anyone else to have them. I don't want to have them either. We could do a whole episode about Lance Stroll, couldn't we? And I think, to your point there, Katie, about responsibility, I think one of the big things that is frustrating about Stroll is when you talk to Aston Martin, because clearly, I think people at Aston Martin don't want to criticize him, because obviously, anyone who works for Aston Martin, a Stroll is the one who ultimately is dictating their job and dictating their, you know, their paycheck. Remember last year in Qatar, it was baffling, you know, when he pushed his trainer and clearly pushed him. Do you remember that? He walked into the back of the garage, pushed him, and they said, no, you know, and they brushed it off. And it was like, well, and then he gave a really short and curt interview to one of the guys at F1. And it was just, it's just the attitude with Stroll that is so frustrating. And, you know, the performances aren't great either, which, you know, when you're up against Fernando Alonso, it's difficult to work that out. Like, I don't really rate Stroll myself as a driver, but I'd be fascinated to see how he would do if it wasn't Fernando, because let's not forget, he didn't do too badly compared to Vettel. Now, you know, say what you read into that what you will about Sebastian Vettel's talent versus Fernando Alonso's, whatever. But yeah, it's just very difficult to have anything kind of glowingly positive to say about Stroll at the moment, because he just seems to be, at the moment, he seems to be the guy. If it's not Logan Sargeant crashing out or doing something, it's like, well, it's going to be Stroll. And when as soon as he went into the pits and on, you saw him drop down the order on the thing, I was like, he's hit someone. I just knew. And then they showed a replay, and I'm not saying I knew he'd gone into the back of Ricardo or anything, but I was like, something's happened there that because, you know, he's just pitted at the end of safety car, and it was spot on.
Other side of that incident was Daniel Ricciardo. Lawrence, how do you feel about his stock at this moment?
Yeah, I'd be tentatively putting some money in, just on the basis that it was a much better weekend. He got the new chassis that he'd been promised by RB, because he had some just concerns at the back of his mind that maybe the chassis he had originally, there wasn't something quite right with it. They couldn't find anything obvious, but yeah, he went to that. And sometimes that's a psychological thing. And in F1, the margins are so small that a small little psychological advantage means that you drive that little bit more confidence into a corner, which means your tires are in that little better window. And then that brings more performance and more performance. So my hope is that this is a bit of an upward curve for Daniel Ricciardo now, because, you know, whether he remains in F1 long term or is a serious consideration for Red Bull or whatever, I don't know. I mean, I think we're kind of not really in that conversation at all anymore. But I don't want to see him just completely fizzle out with his career this year. I want him to go down fighting and kind of like show us what he can do, in the hope that if he is good enough and if he does perform on the level that I think we all know he probably can in the right conditions, then maybe there's a space still for him in Formula One.
George Russell, Nathaniel.
I'd be buying. I think, you know, I wrote another piece this week. One thing that's really interesting at the moment is in behind Max. You know, Max is very one-sided in the championship. If you look at most teams, maybe bar Ferrari, really one-sided teammate comparisons at this point of the year, head-to-head. And George is completely outperforming Lewis at the moment across the board. And now, you know, you could say, well, Lewis's head maybe isn't in the game since he went to Ferrari or whatever. But, you know, I think Russell more and more is looking, you know, like a... I think we've always known he's the long-term future of Mercedes, but this is exactly when Mercedes are in the position they're in, he's performing well. So yeah, I would buy. And I think maybe less so than Lando, but in a similar vein, like at some point things are going to come good, you would hope, for Mercedes, and you would hope for Russell. And I think when they do, he's shown he'll be in the, you know, he'll be in the right frame of mind, the right form, etc. to capitalize. So yeah, I'd be buying some for sure.
Do you agree, Laz, on George Russell?
Yeah, I think he's also his performances versus Lewis this year have shown that he is good. I don't think we're seeing the best Lewis Hamilton right now. You know, there could be multiple reasons for that. But I think what George is showing is that he's a very capable of driver, which I think we knew already. And he's going to be Mercedes, unless Max goes there, he's going to be a Mercedes team leader, I think, going forward.
To that point, Lewis Hamilton, his teammate, would you just be holding his stock at this point to see what happens when he does get to Ferrari? Or would you start selling, if I can even believe I'm saying that about Lewis Hamilton?
Yeah, I think because that stock would be worth so much, assuming I've held it now for a few years, perhaps I'd be tempted to try and cash in. But also, it would depend on what the market's doing. If other people are selling Lewis stock because he's not doing so well right now, I'd hold. I'd go against the trend of the market, knowing that he's going to Ferrari and that ultimately, yeah, I think Lewis at Ferrari, you're going to want to have some of that stock left, right? You know, because that is a very exciting proposition. So, if his stock was still high, I'd be cautiously maybe just selling off a little bit to invest in some of the other people I've been talking about so far. I think you definitely want to leave some in there for the Ferrari move.
10 seconds on the clock. How many things can you name that are always growing? Your relationships, your skills, your customer base. How about businesses on Shopify? Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/network, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/network now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/network. This podcast is proud to be supported by Jet's Pizza, the number one pick in Detroit-style pizza. Why? It's simple. Jet's is better. With the thickest, crispiest, cheesiest Detroit-style pizza in the country, there's no competition. Right now, get $5 off any 8-corner pizza with code 8SAVE. That's the number 8. SAVE. Go to jetspizza.com to learn more and find a location near you. Again, try Jet's signature 8-corner pizza and get $5 off with code 8SAVE. That's the number 8, SAVE. Jet's Pizza. Better because it has to be.
Couple teams that I want to throw at you guys. Nate, would you buy, hold, or sell William stock at this point?
Oh, that's a really good one. I think I'd buy. I think I would tentatively, with a bit of trepidation, maybe. You know, if I'd made a bit of money selling some Lewis stock high, like selling higher Lewis or something. I think Williams is a really fascinating team to look at on the grid because obviously they've got Albon there, who I think is fantastic. And I've really been impressed with James Vowles is kind of trying to drag that team kind of, you know, into the modern era. You know, there's a lot of infrastructure stuff that he's really trying to improve. And, you know, we've seen how far behind that team is with the chassis situation, stuff like that. And they have owners that are willing to spend, you know, and are willing to invest in the team. Maybe not as much as James Vowles wants, but I think a lot of it will hinge on what they do with Sargeant's seat. I'd hope they'd get a competitive driver in. I've heard some people suggesting Sainz should go there instead of Sauber, which I don't see the long-term logic of, but if Williams could pull that off, that would be pretty mega. Even though they've got no points, I would say, you know, maybe speculatively, but I would say that they're one of the teams in that bottom pack who the feeling around them is, you know, is maybe more positive. Like if you compare them to like an Alpine or something, you know, it's much more positive. So yeah, I would say buy.
Don't hedge and slight the way people view Alpine before I get to ask about it.
Yeah, sorry. Okay? I'm influencing the market already.
It's a loaded question. Laz, would you buy, sell, or hold Alpine as a whole at this point?
Well, I'd be tempted to hold just so that I could be in the same club as Rory McIlroy and Anthony Joshua and all the celebrities that actually hold stock in that team.
That's a selfish answer.
But no, I think... No, realistically, yeah, you would be going to sell there because, I mean, the results aren't there. It's been a bad start to the season. They update, inevitably things are going to get a little bit better, but I just don't know. I just don't see the long-term vision for that team when you've got, you know, your existing very successful teams in Formula One, the likes of Aston Martin investing heavily, McLaren clearly on an upward curve overall when you look at the 5 years. And then the likes of Sauber with Audi investment coming in, you know, you think, can Alpine really put together a team and a package that will compete with all of those, you know, even into 2026, 2027, 2028? I just don't see it. So I would be selling.
I'd be selling.
Okay.
I'd be selling. But I would have already sold. But I would be, I would have sold several years ago. I think, Alpine. I mean, yeah, I don't know what Alpine are doing. It ain't good.
Nate, for once, is at a loss of words. He doesn't even know what to say. He's that baffled.
Yeah. It's rare, but Alpine have done it to me.
Yeah. I appreciate you playing. I want to round out the episode with maybe something that'll become its own segment in the future. I have two questions that were submitted to me to put forth to you two from a co-host that I work on a radio station. His name's Roddy Jones. He does college football, college baseball for ESPN. He listens to us weekly, so avid listener, which we appreciate. If you have questions as you listen or watch, leave it in the chat. I'm going to make more work for Zach. He's going to have to go and pull through each week. Or tweet any three of us, and we will obviously answer it on the following pod, Katie_George05. Happy to answer your questions, but these are Roddy's two questions for the two of you. He says this is always... Interesting question. He says, this has always been top of mind. Why is Mercedes' entire operation in their garage and not on the pit wall like other teams, Laz?
It's not. So, yeah, that is true to an extent, but it's not the entire operation. It's basically Toto Wolff. And that's the person that the cameras most love to follow for obvious reasons because of the reactions he gives. But the team manager, Ron Meadows, is on the pit wall. Andrew Shovlin, the chief engineer, is on the pit wall. I believe the driver race engineers are in the garage, but I'd have to double check that. So it is a bit of a split and a little bit different to how some of the other teams do it. Toto, I think, has often talked about this and said he's not needed on the pit wall. Him being on the pit wall would be only for show. And, you know, I think that's a bit of a dig at other team principals that do go up there. Christian Horner, for example. To be fair, most of them. But he's always said, look, if he needs to intervene, he's got a radio button dead ahead of him. Mm-hmm. And he also used to joke often that radio button doesn't actually do anything. He's just shouting at himself. That's not true. It does go through to some people. The way he likes to manage it is that when it comes down to decisions in the race, he's leaving it to the engineers. And if he needs to get involved because it's a wider decision on something, he will. But that separation there, I think, is kind of symbolic of that as well. So, that's the reason. But they do have a pit wall with the key engineers on it.
Second question. His words, not mine. Okay, Nate. He asks, does Carlos Sainz just not give a shit about what Ferrari says anymore? Because I know he's raced Charles Leclerc over the years, but it seems like he's being a little bit more flippant with it this season.
Yeah, absolutely. I think... And also, Ferrari can't expect him to play ball all the time. You know, they've kicked him to the curb, and his career still is completely up in the air because of that. I think it's been said. I think Carlos has always raced with a bit of a chip on his shoulder, just generally. You know, because he's been cast aside by a lot of different teams. He never fully got full deals, and I feel like we're seeing all of that frustration bubble up into an even more kind of elbows out aggressive kind of style. I think it's one of those as well where it was a sprint race. I don't think from memory Carlos went fully over the line with it. Be interesting mm-hmm. to see if that was, for a podium in a race or for a victory in a race. I think there is part of that, isn't there, where it must be interesting being like, right, we've got to relay to him now to calm down or to, to not race someone. I think you would second guess yourself of what the answer is going to be.
I think it's only natural for there to be like a little inkling of who are you to tell me what to do at this point when you didn't, obviously back me or extend my contract and you're bringing in somebody else. But just interesting questions.
And I suppose as well, part of it, if you're still trying to convince other teams mm-hmm. you're the guy, it's a weird one, isn't it? Because on the one hand, you want to show you're a good teammate and all that. And Carlos can probably turn around and say, well, look, I have been. What you also want to do is you want to say, well, look, no, I don't lie down easily. Like I've got some fight in me. So, and I think Carlos Sainz, that is one of his strengths. He's always got the bit between his teeth and he goes for it. So yeah, I think it's part of it is him kind of showcasing what he's about to whoever else is interested.
Well, first, thanks to Roddy Jones for submitting the two questions. Second, thanks to you two for answering them. If you have questions, leave it in the comment on our YouTube page, ESPN F1, or tweet at Katie_George05, and we will happily discuss whatever questions you have on upcoming Unlapped. Speaking of upcoming Unlapped, that's tricky, so I will never say that again. We're going to be live from sunny Miami next week. Safe travels to the two of you. We cannot wait for the first U.S. Grand Prix in the season of the season at this point. You know what? I'm just going to mercifully get off the f***ing air at this point. I'll see you in Miami. Can't wait to talk to you both. Cheers.